My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Dan Snow is a filmmaker, a television presenter, a best-selling author, and the ideal person to help us kick off our investigation into what the past can teach us about the future. I'm sitting down with him for a chat about the state of the world today, the state of the world tomorrow, and whether or not there's anything we can do about it. Welcome to Future Imperfect. How do you feel that your own perspective kind of impacts on how you talk about history?
Jason, when I was 21, I think I knew everything. And there was nothing I didn't know about history. And now the older I get, the more I think, yeah, my goodness me, it's all so contingent on who we are and what's going on in our life. Because suddenly I read every history book and all I read is Donald Trump, Boris Johnson, climate breakdown. I'm just reading about, you know, contemporary issues. Even though I'm reading about the Medici or I'm reading about Chinese history recently, I just keep feeling, oh, yeah, that's exactly like, you know, Jeff Bezos at the moment, you know, and all the, you know, the privatization of our space endeavors and things like that. So I think I'm hopeless. I'm the worst. I think I'm always putting myself and my world into the past whenever I read it. I did a really interesting pod the other day with a woman who was writing about working motherhood, you know, this extraordinary transformation in history from sort of women who work and then they're sort of in the domestic sphere and then they go out to work and how and when that all occurs. And she was saying that her experience of living through lockdown and trying to be a working mother and homeschooling and things, even though she was absolutely, she studied this for years and wrote a prize-winning book, she said it's transformed her opinion on writing the history. So I think we are really important in the way that we think about the past, I think, surely.
Yeah, I'd agree entirely. I think the now reflects how we interpret the past almost entirely. It's very difficult to put yourself in the position of somebody and remove knowledge. Now, I was looking at the Mapa Mundi the other day and thinking, what an incredible artifact that is. And yeah, it was a tourist attraction apart from anything. You know, you've gone all the way to Hereford Cathedral. What else can you pay a penny to go and see? And the Mapa Mundi is the summary of the world with Jerusalem at the middle and heaven at the top. And it's almost a mind map. And I'm not sure that anybody really thought it was actually geographical as much as a sort of a reflection of how the world was seen at the time by many people in the West. And I wonder, when we look at Magna Carta, for example, and the things that run up to that, and we reflect on it, I think it's only four clauses of it that are actually relevant anymore. A lot of it was about fishing, which is fascinating when I read it. It's obsessed with fishing.
Yeah, fish traps and religious things.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah. But it's so hard to put ourselves in the minds of the people that were there fighting for what they saw. Not really, because it wasn't ordinary people's rights, was it? It was more about the barons can't be abused and had their own armies than ordinary people. There was no consideration really for ordinary, quotes, people. But when you're presenting, when you're putting together your ideas for history, how do you start with them and how do you reflect on it? Do you write scripts or do you extemporize and as you're presenting, explore the idea?
Well, so much, Jason, that's interesting in there. But I think just on your first point about the Math Monday and all that sort of stuff, I think, isn't it interesting also how this year, suddenly with the pandemic, Black Lives Matter, awareness of violence towards women that we've all had here in the UK recently, and maybe around, you know, the big government versus little government. Oh, maybe big government's back, because it's kind of useful when there's a giant pandemic on. And also, sorry, I keep thinking of the list, but also the reemergence of like great power rivalry between China and the US, between arguably China, Russia and the US. Suddenly, those things that I wouldn't have been sensitive to if I'd written it when I was writing a book about the Battle of Quebec 10 years ago, suddenly I'm like, should I have talked about slavery more in this book? Like, it's kind of weird. Or should I have talked about these, just your choice of adjectives? And it's so true. And when I go back and read history books written in the Edwardian period, they were like condemnatory of Henry I for like wearing stupid clothes and being a bit effeminate and possibly having sex with men. You know, like that was like absolutely devastating. Whereas we tend to probably go, wow, their treatment of women was truly remarkable in this period, or their kind of use, just their embrace of violence. Like they're just violence, a kind of practical everyday tool of government. That's something the Edwardians maybe were a bit more chilled about. So I think it's so interesting. In terms of how I'm working at the moment, well, you know, like you, I'm kind of really embracing and really, really enjoying this new world in which we're living around sort of digital content. So now most of my work is online and it's either sort of podcasts or TV shows, but I don't write scripts like I used to, because I think writing scripts in the old days, there were a lot of gatekeepers, certainly when I worked at the BBC, and there'd be levels of command. They don't want to see a script because they want to make sure you weren't going to embarrass them or the BBC, or, you know, and sometimes that was absolutely right. They had a very high standard of factual accuracy at the BBC, which was great and remains, particularly in this fake news environment that we're in now, I think really important. But a lot of it was also just around everyone wanted to chip in with ideas. And I think you've moved into movie making, and I'm sure you're very much cutting a different path. But, you know, traditionally within movies, there were these, you know, hugely bureaucratic processes. Scripts went in one end and came out the other about something completely different, virtually. So I'm moving away from scripts now and trying to keep it a lot fresher. And I know from your online work that I've watched, it's, you know, you're a big believer in freshness.
Yes.
and I think, why not? You know, like, I love now just going out, and I was out kayaking the other day out here off my house. We went out to Hurst Castle, which has seen Henry VIII's castles, where it's sadly undermined by time and tide, and it's collapsing into the Solent. And it was just like, right, no script. It was the day after the collapse happened. Let's get out there. It was, you've got your bullet points, the things you want to cover. You know, in that way, I'd be really interested actually how you work, because you come from a gaming world where you have to storyboard it. But, you know, I had my bullet points, and then I thought the audience want to hear freshness. You know, it's like, as long as you're delivering that content, and you've always got what we call in the industry voiceover for your listeners. That's when you're watching pictures and it's the presenter's voice just kind of mysteriously appears, rather than a piece to camera where you can see them talking. The voiceover is the bit where they add their voice to pictures later. And you can put a lot of the heavy content in there if you want. Well, then don't worry, in 1542 this happened. So if you don't remember everything you want to say on location, that's fine. Because I believe the bit that are interesting on location and stuff I see you do is, you know, my sword arm is just absolutely exhausted. It just shows, you know, this is, my horse is behaving in a certain way. And so I was out there talking about the Solent, the tides. Oh, you know, here I am, my kayak. That's the stuff you can't replicate. And it's also the stuff it's hard to script, because you want to talk about the tides. Well, if you go out the wrong time of day, the tide is going from left to right, not right to left. So I was in meetings when I was a kid, broadcaster at the BBC, and they were like, you know, make sure you mention here about the big crowds of people that go to this shrine every week. And you're like, well, hang on, we're not going to be there at a weekend. There's going to be no people. It's just like, leave it up to us. Leave it up to your field agents to work that out on the day. You know, and there were these people in the office didn't want to give too much power to people going out. But now I'm completely on the other side. I'm much more swashbuckling, I believe, in getting out there, finding out what the story is, having your facts, having your bullet points in your ammo case, but using them as and when the situation, and let the pictures and the action kind of tell the story and carry the narrative.
I'd agree with you entirely. I think authenticity of voice and your immediate response, you go somewhere and you might have read about it, but when you go there and experience it, it might bring out a whole different area of thought for you. I mean, there's a story I tell in one of the things about jousting, closing my visor, and then a fly flying into my helmet and buzzing around. And for me, when it was happening, it was a bit distracting. And then afterwards, I thought, that must have happened in history, but nobody would ever write about it. It's a very personal experience, and it's funny, but also distracting, and you know, potentially could be lethal, that kind of small moment. But it's the sort of thing, it's one of the reasons why I love the horses and I like actually trying things out, is personal experience is quite rare. I mean, I love my book history and I love the whole academic side of it and the studying old documents and things, but they are one perspective on history and often written from a clever perspective or with a view to the legacy you're going to leave behind when you write the book, as opposed to complaining about the quality of the copper that's just been sent to you because it's rubbish. And some of those early Mesopotamian tablets are ordinary lives. And it's something I'm fascinated by. Kings and emperors are all wonderful, but what are ordinary people's lives like? And how did they brush their teeth? How did they make fire? What did they do to get up in the morning like we all do? You know, how did people wash? Because hot water is a rare and expensive thing. So you're going to be washing in cold water a lot of the time. It's not very nice, to be honest.
Jason, every time I have it, this is what it is to be a weird historian. Listen, certainly history fans, like, you know, like I am, but anyone listening to this is what it is. Like, every time I'm in a hot shower, I think, this is a bloody miracle. Yes. I'm in a house, I'm not even on the ground floor, and there's a system that pumps hot water onto me and changes my day every time I have a shower. Like, it's like essential to well-being. And it's like, that's historically speaking, that's a kind of miracle. Mm. You know, only the kings and emperors would have had that, you know, 1,000 years ago. It's a marvel, isn't it? But I think, Jason, you're in a wonderful position because you're answerable to no one. You've built this empire by yourself. You don't have to worry about anyone. There are no gatekeepers. There's no one who you're trying to impress. And I think what's great about you, go, this is what I'm interested in. I suspect other people can be interested in it too. And it is it's the bits of, I mean, the fly in the visor is great fun. And you know, people are always really rude about TV history. And nowadays we'd call it, I don't know, online video history. And because one of the things you have to do, as everyone who's watched TV shows knows, is as a presenter, you've got to go and, like, you know, try and row the Viking ship, or you try and shovel coal into the firebox of a 19th century train. But I can honestly say, I feel it's been a great privilege for me to do those things. And it has made me, if and when I ever did want to return to try and being a proper historian, it will have made me a much, much better historian. Because there are certain things that only become very clear, and they become instantly clear. It's like standing on the deck of a ship and getting seasick. Like, oh, I'm now seasick and everything has changed. Like, I just want to... Or actually, something I experienced the other day, I had my first kind of adult chronic pain thing. You know, I had a condition, a little thing, thank goodness got fixed. But for a couple of weeks, I was in pain constantly. And I thought, this is the shittest experience of my life. And if someone walked up to me now and offered me £2 million, if I could have this pain for another year or 10 years, I would immediately say no. Like, it would be a no-brainer. And, you know, as you know so well, so many people in the past, decision makers, people who changed the course of history, they would have been living with chronic pain or with bereavement, like savage bereavement issues, kids dying, plague, who knows. And that's something that I just don't see in books. I just don't see that. Well, you know, yeah, everyone's like, well, it's fascinating. Why did that king decide to do that? It makes no sense. Perhaps it was because of this. It's like, no. What if it wasn't because of that? What if he was like James II, not putting up much of a fight against William III when he landed in 1688? What if it's because James II had these chronic nosebleeds? The weather was terrible. It felt kind of apocalyptic. And he just completely, as we all do every day, he just lost his morale. And there's no deep statute law or texts or kind of 17th century philosophy that explains it. It's just he had an absolute shocker and collapsed, as you and I know. You probably haven't, but I certainly have. Yeah. And I think that stuff is so... I mean, I learned so much sailing this Viking boat. I'm sure you've done it, but if you haven't, it's...
No, I haven't yet. No, it's something I really want to do, yeah.
Right, because it's right in your ballpark. Roskilde... And we left Roskilde and we sailed north and we were going up Jutland and we were eating the stuff and we were sailing the ship and then the weather, like, and also the weather for... He said, look, we haven't got Google Maps or anything. We haven't got charts. But you know where Sweden is. It's there. You know where Denmark... Because look at the clouds. You just know. You look at them. The clouds are completely different over land, even though you can't see the land. He goes, the Baltic is a very good place to learn how to sail and it's kind of safe. And then we ran in up the beach. We had a problem with something holding our rudder to the side of the ship. Turns out you need a sapling, silver birch tree, and you stick it through and then you use the roots to tie the roots around the steering oar, and then the tree, then you bring it through a hole in the hull and that lashes it to the hull basically, and then you have a steering oar. And we went into a supermarket car park and chopped a tree down. We chopped one of those, you know, in the supermarkets, you always got those little, they always plant those to try and make the community happy. Yeah. And we asked permission, and then we chopped the trees down, and we just carried it off with us. And you just thought, my God, every single thing on this boat, as long as you've got some iron ingots, like some, and again, you know better than I do, but you need a bit of iron around, so you can take that as ballast. But as long as you've got that, wherever you stop, you can make fire, you can do blacksmithing, and you can basically make that boat again. If you've got wood, you've got the techniques, you can go, oh, well, you know, we have to replace 10, 12, 40 planks. That's how you can do that. And being out with them and experiencing that was, I feel, knowledge that you could not gain from a book.
Yeah, it's the knowledge. I mean, I think one of the things that we often forget is the incredible adaptability of the human mind to solve problems if you really have to. You know, you're there, you're stuck, you've got a plank that's gone on your boat. Okay, we'll fix it, lads. You know, you have no alternative. You can't phone anybody and ask for rescue. That nobody's going to come. There's no admin either. I often feel like the world is controlled by bits of paper that allow us to travel from X place to Y place, and we've got to get permission for this, and this is the way it's done. But back in those days, it was, we have a boat, we have a bunch of brawny lads, and we have weapons, because that's an important part of it. Who's going to stop us? Only somebody who has more brawny lads and weapons, because we're going over there to explore. And the sort of nature of exploring is that they might have to fight. And because death was ever present, you know, child mortality was awful, and you would be killing animals to eat them. Even if you didn't enjoy it, you would be doing that. So the idea of death and life was very different than it is now. I mean, we go into, and I'm guilty of this as well, but, you know, death for modern people is, for most people in the West anyway, is very removed, mostly, not all the time, but is largely quite removed from us. Whereas earlier periods, medieval period in particular, it was very immediate and very apparent. And as you say, I mean, sorry, Henry VIII had that suppurating wound for decades that stank. And, you know, he's a powerful king, an export star, by the standards of the time, tall, very handsome, incredibly wealthy, decided to be in charge of his own church, so he'd even got that on his side. And there was nothing he could do about the pain and the stench of his leg. And he would have been completely aware of it hurting and distracting him at every moment, even in the most intimate moments of his life. He's going to be in pain. And, you know, I lived with, for 2 weeks, lived with tooth pain. And quite frankly, it was extraordinarily debilitating.
Yeah.
And it was like, great, I can finally, and it was such a relief psychologically as well as physically to get rid of it. But imagine being that all-powerful king who can't get rid of that pain at all. And you can even see the cutout in the royal armouries on his armour. There's a piece missing in one of his greaves, which is where they suppose the suppurating wound was. But imagine that just as a psychological impact on you, let alone the stench that would have been coming from that kind of wound. Yeah, amazing he wasn't worse, to be honest.
Well, agree. I completely agree with that. And I'm very struck as well by your comment. The thing I struggle with history about death and our relationship to it. You know, I've been very, very privileged in my life, and I've been absolutely incredibly lucky that the only people I know who've died, I'm 42 years old, the only people I know who've died have been really old, you know, intimate to me, the close family. And it's been a great loss. But you know, I'm very, very lucky. And I know that's perhaps unusual even today, but it would have been unheard of in the 15th century. And I don't know whether sometimes there, you read about these lives. Now, of course, you're reading about the kind of exceptional lives because that's the ones you're, that's why you're reading them. But they just lived with a certain velocity, a certain energy that makes you think maybe they weren't worried about their pension. We like go, oh, it's worth putting 5 years in at this company because you might get, you know. But maybe they go, well, I don't know if I'm going to be alive in 5 years' time. So maybe there was a pace to their life that we think we live fast-paced today. But, I mean, some of these characters that you read about were getting in scrapes. And I mean, I just did a podcast on Cellini, the Renaissance artist. I mean, he's lived harder than any rock star today, any soldier, any, you know. There must have been a sense that, you know, this could all end tomorrow, frankly. I've buried my siblings, I've buried my kids, I've buried my friends. Was there a kind of, let's live for the day kind of spirit among so many of the people that you've studied, particularly in your field?
I think very likely, actually. I think the idea that disease, death, you know, violent death often was around the corner. And, Let's face it, if you don't have a... police are a fairly recent invention. I mean, you had somebody murdered, there's a hue and cry and there's all these sort of... But if you can get away, the communication is only as fast as a fast horse. And if somebody is baddie on a fast horse, they're ahead anyway. And can you ever find them? But I agree. I think there's a certain fatalistic approach to it, which is I'm just going to go off and have adventures. And I wonder whether that's a Viking thing. Whether, in fact, it's not about rape and pillage and thievery. It's just about, come on, lads, let's go and do something interesting with our lives. And let's sail in that direction and see what adventures we can have. And sometimes those adventures turn violent and pillage and all sorts of bad things. But sometimes they discover whole continents.
Yeah, I was reading about Polynesians the other day. So, you know, as well as the Vikings, I think the most remarkable maritime culture in our history. And the Polynesians, there was a sense that they weren't chased out of their homelands or by like a lack of material resources. Or, you know, there was an idea that the Vikings, there was a bit of a population explosion, maybe not enough arable land, and those kind of reasons. But reading about the Polynesians, it just did seem to be particularly young men, but young people going, no, let's live a life less ordinary. Let's try and make a name for ourselves and go beyond the horizon. And I can't help think that's right. And I was reading about 18th century, which is, you know, we think about press gangs and the Navy was so hard and it was rum, sodomy and the lash. And actually there was enormous amounts of volunteering for the Navy in the 18th century. And I think lots of people, like a young Captain Cook, James Cook, who then became Captain Cook, he had a life on the colliers of Eastern England, going from Newcastle to London. And he chose to join the Navy. He volunteered. And I think it was the path of a life of adventure and potentially financial gain as well. But I mean, life tied to a small holding in early modern or medieval England would have been pretty grim, and never travelling 30 miles from where you were born. I mean, like, I think swapping that for adventure and, you know, potential, well, great risk, I think would have made sense.
Yeah. And also, you know, the power of actually being fed as well, because, you know, in our immediate society, you know, we can always go down, or we can't always, but, you know, at the moment we can go down to the supermarket and get food at the drop of a hat. And many people don't have any food in their dwelling. They know they're going to go somewhere for the next meal. Whereas back then you had to grow your food or buy it from the local area, and it might not be available. You might be hungry. And I think it's easy to underestimate the value of, you'll be fed 3 square meals a day in the army. And yes, you'll be treated in a rough way, but you'll actually have adventures and you'll be fed. And that's incredibly compelling to most young men. Young women obviously weren't invited, but for the young men being told, yeah, your alternative is to do what your dad has done, which is follow this plough backwards and forwards and the arses of these oxen backwards and forwards, or risk everything, your life included, but who cares, because you're young and nobody thinks they're going to die. And you can have adventures in far off lands and possibly earn riches and meet strange people. I mean, if you think about it from that perspective, I'm surprised they even needed press gangs. I'm surprised they actually ever needed to force people into the boats. It's fascinating, fascinating period. And then never leaving the ship, unfortunately, for quite a long time. That doesn't sound so good either. What happened to the adventures? That'll come in a few years. Really? Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, the idea of Napoleonic recruiting sergeants as well, and the idea of the king's shilling and then the king's shilling being taken off you for all your equipment. I always thought it was strange, but I can understand it from their perspective. And as historians, or amateur historians in my case, I think you've got to try to put yourself in their position and understand the world as best you can, not from your own perspective of hot running water, easily available food, perfect communications, an ability to speak to anybody with a magic box pretty much anywhere in the world simultaneously. These are things that were literally fantasy or impossible to even conceive of not that long ago.
Yeah. And the hardest one, of course, is the hardest one for many people is First World War infantry. You know, the idea that these young men climbed out of those trenches, and it wasn't just a fear of being shot by their own sergeant. It was, seems to be, that they were willing participants in those attacks that we now know had very little chance of success. And many of them were killed, shot, machine gunned and blown to pieces by shrapnel and left to dangle on the barbed wire. And it's, you know, I've been at the centre of a few internet storms, and most of them very deserved. But the one I was most interested by was when I tried to just write about what motivated those First World War soldiers, and the fact that many of them enjoyed, many of them, not all of them, some, you know, many of the millions of people who served kind of enjoyed their experiences in the First World War. And as you say, there was food, there were long periods out of the trenches, there were long periods of being behind the lines, and the camaraderie, the sexual opportunities, the travel, the money, you're making money. Some of the risks didn't seem quite as severe as they do now, because being in industrial communities, being in a mining community in 1910, you'd have been used to catastrophic loss of life in the most appalling circumstances imaginable, buried underground, you know, all that stuff, explosions of gases. So there are a whole bunch of reasons why, for us, the choices and the experiences of that generation just seem like, you know, inexplicable. But at the time, as you so rightly say, that it, you know, these things make sense. It was a shocking experience for many, many of them who lived with debilitating physical and mental wounds for the rest of their lives. But for many people, they could have got away with it. If they're at the right place, the right time, war could have been perhaps even enjoyable.
Mm. I mean, it's interesting, sort of brought up the idea of what we understand now as PTSD and the long-term mental effects of combat. And I always wonder, when you look back through the historical record, do we see potential examples of exactly those phenomena, but not understood? You know, the Battle of Towton, people slaughtering each other in the thousands.
God.
By hand, you know, literally seeing somebody there and smashing their face in with a hammer and doing that repeatedly. Surely that would have generated just as much PTSD in those people. And can we tease that out of the historical record at all? What happened to these people afterwards? Did they become traveling vagabonds? Presumably there was a certain amount of suicide afterwards, you know, people that couldn't cope with it, and all the things that would manifest and we would understand more today back in the old days. I mean, did the ancient Greeks suffer from PTSD, those phalanxes that they had, and people being stabbed to death or crushed, or just doesn't bear thinking about? And is history filled with people with these problems? I think probably the answer is yes, but we just don't know about it very much.
Yeah, there was a great professor at my university who sort of said, was it worse to drag a pike in the 30 Years' War, when armies were just ripped apart by starvation and typhus and dysentery? Or was it worse to be a British-German serviceman in the First World War? And some, you know, you start to sort of crunch the numbers. And obviously there was something unique about the First World War because of the kind of industrialized slaughter, the randomness of death, potentially, the sort of, you know, you could, like, Ernst Jünger, Storm of Steel, he's behind the lines, and suddenly his whole platoon is just wiped out by a stray British shell. And it's that, I think, that nature of the kind of randomness, arbitrariness, no safe areas within reason. I think that must have been particularly weird and must have discombobulated people. But yeah, watching your mates cough their guts out and you know, bleeding out in any of these conflicts, and with casualty rates per capita far higher than the Battle of the Somme. You know, not unusual for armies to lose half their strength in battles that you'll have covered and I've looked at. And so I agree. It's funny you said that. I'm quite interested, and if anyone listens to this and wants to send me any examples, I love raking through early sources and for any reference of PTSD. There are some from the Battle of Trafalgar, Napoleonic Wars, so the early days of Bethlehem Hospital, which gave its name to sort of Bedlam, the expression Bedlam. Mm. So many of its early inmates, or early recorded inmates, like 19th century visitors, would say, oh, you know, quite obviously there's a few people in here from the French wars. And it's like, well, obviously that's fascinating. You know, so there were absolutely former servicemen who were at Trafalgar, Waterloo, elsewhere, whose minds had just been terribly, terribly damaged by what they'd seen. Can you imagine the gun deck of a ship in that period? You know, cannonballs coming through, supersonic splinters cartwheeling around, razor sharp, ripping people in half, ripping people open. Decks painted red so you wouldn't notice the amount of blood on the deck. I mean, I defy anyone to think that was somehow better or nicer than the industrial warfare of the 20th century. So I think definitely it's an area that I'm totally fascinated by. But as you say, anyone who saw the bridge of dead at Towton across that river, they must have been changed, surely.
You would think so. You would think, because we, as human beings, we haven't changed that much. Our psychology is largely the same. You know, we have different educational standards and probably different expectations of what our lives should be. But even so, that river, that beck running red with blood, is just such a strong, horrible image. vast numbers of men on both sides. And one of those horrible brother-on-brother battles where nobody is kind of wanting to give up and everybody is just willing to pile into the slaughter. It's absolutely, absolutely awful. But I wonder whether in the future... So one of the things I sometimes speculate on is what will we be looking back at as humanity in 500 years onto today's situation? What will we see about today that we think of as normal that will seem really extraordinary to them? And one of the examples, there's a couple of examples just to kind of kick off this thought, is I used to drive along the Foss Way to get to and from Oxford. And occasionally, I was driving along there in a little Mini, my first car, very, very pleased to have that, and thinking there must have been Roman soldiers walking along here a few thousand years ago. I wonder if any of them were thinking what will be here in 1,000 years' time, what will it be here in 2,000 years' time? And here's me 2,000 years later thinking, hello, Roman soldier, I wonder if you're thinking about me. And then I thought, I wonder if the Foss Way will still be there in some way in another 2,000 years. And then looking back at today, how will historians look at Brexit as a major issue, potentially look at the American elections and the all sorts of complexities that are going on in politics in the world, information storm, fake news, all of this is going to be seen in some kind of context. And I always wonder what that context will be and how they will describe us. Are we the new Dark Ages? I don't know.
First of all, I know I'm among friends when people say I was driving on the Fossway rather than the A303. That's how we should refer to our modern road network by the Roman.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
I think that is the most interesting question, isn't it? I mean, I can't help thinking, well, first of all, in 500 years' time, I don't think anybody will remember Donald Trump or Boris Johnson or, well, hopefully not President Xi or Vladimir Putin, short of a catastrophic nuclear interstate war that sees a sort of discontinuity of life on Earth. I hope these kind of political leaders come and go. I think it's going to be, of course, the internet and technology, isn't it? This kind of transformation in how we communicate with each other and do business and do everything. Now with even areas that 15 years ago we thought were probably pretty safe, like sex and dating and finding partners. Now the internet dominates that space as well. Who knew? And it may come to dominate medicine, for example, in the next few years. You know, even areas that we don't know yet. I think that's something that they will be thinking about. I can't help thinking that they will find the climate breakdown fascinating. I mean, there's guys like me who sort of make all the right noises about climate, but I hop on planes left, right and centre and I eat beef and I've bought an electric car, but I'm not out there with Greta Thunberg on the streets, even though I know that this is a potentially existential catastrophe for us all. They might find that a bit weird. They might find that, like, those generations sort of knew it was coming but they did bits and bobs around the edges, but they didn't go on a kind of wartime footing until it was too late. So I think that's going to be something that's really interesting for people to watch as we attempt to kind of decarbonize our economies and whether that happens soon enough. And I think the things that we're able to do to our bodies, right? The science that, we were able to, we're having these amazing debates at the moment of furious screaming fights about biological sex and gender. Well, and they're kind of partly coming about because we have developed the technology to change many of the biological characteristics from one sex to another. That's only going to increase. When's the clever pill coming out? When's the pill that's going to upgrade our memories or upgrade our systems, really? And I think so that kind of biochemical side of it as well, I think is hugely important. And then space. I think space. When Neil Armstrong died, I thought he's a good chance. He's the only person from the 20th century who'll be remembered in 1,000 years' time. That's really interesting
because he was first man. Yeah.
Because we find, you know, Mao and Stalin and Hitler and Churchill, whoever else, you know, who today has heard of Charles V or Montezuma? Like, I mean, not many. Like, those political leaders are not that important. Even not the genocidal, mass murdering ones. And I suspect it's, if you look back, it's the artist and the scientist and the explorer. I mean, I'm just, this is me off the top of my head, but I think you're more likely to remember, well, depending on artistic tastes, who knows? Maybe Mick Jagger, maybe the Beatles still being played in 1,000 years' time. Maybe, like, you know, Beethoven, maybe they'll still be, you know, but we can't account for taste, so I can't answer that. But I do think that we're going to be living on various different celestial objects by that point. And therefore, the first man to land on one of them, that's a big, he'll get a fair bit of attention, I think, wherever we go in the universe. So, yeah.
Well, I was also thinking about, you know, all the wonderful stuff that various of the space agencies are doing and exploring the planets and landing, you know, rovers on Mars recently, and how incredibly detailed those images are, and how we're slowly building up tiny bits of detritus on Mars. And I was thinking, just like today, some religions build quite complex buildings around a sort of a key rock or a special place for their religion or their, you know, their world belief. I wonder if in, I don't know, 200 years, I think it's very likely actually that where one of those rovers is right now will be the center of a kind of grand Mars exploration museum, and there'll be a dome over it, and the patch of Mars that's on it, complete with the tracks, is going to be visible to visitors, you know, as a sort of pristine piece of Mars real estate. And there's going to be a huge Mars city around it, and it's just going to be one of those things that Mars school kids go to visit. And this is, you know, here's one of the robots, and there's another one somewhere else. And it just fascinates me that might happen in the future.
Well, yeah, like colonial Jamestown in the US, yeah. Or yeah, in Canada, where my mum's from, and, you know, Fort York at the heart of Toronto is this. Now it's under an underpass, and it's kind of, but it is, you know, there is a 18th century fort there, which is, you know, which was the beginning of it all. Well, sorry, the beginning of European settlement of the area. So I completely agree. And in fact, there's a great bit on the archaeology of the moon. There's a lot of stuff on the moon. You should check it out. You know, right, there's a moon buggy. There's the Apollo 11. Well, there's lots of bits of Apollo 11 there. You know, the flag, for example. So the heritage of Mars and the moon is going to be super interesting. I agree.
Yeah. And I just love the idea that one day, some school kids are going to be going, "Mom, this is boring. I've read about this at school." And then they're going on to some other exploration. And for me, I've found as I've got older, history has become more interesting, or rather shifted. I've always been interested in knights and castles and dinosaurs. I don't know why those are sort of big things in my life, but in quite a lot of other people's lives. But also the sort of human side of it has expanded. And I reflect on what it might have been like to be there. And then I sometimes, through my computer games, which often examine game-playing futures and things like that, I always sort of, what if the future? And is there a period in history that you would love to revisit now to sort of solve a puzzle or explain something that still bugs you? I mean, there's sort of classic moments in history, I suppose, but I've always wanted to go back to have a look at a major battle to see whether battles are really fought the way we think they were fought.
Oh, no, of course. But first of all, I just love your point about the kid going on the school trip. The idea of going on a school trip on the moon to look at the descent stage of the Apollo lunar, the lander, which is still there. It's like, you know, the sort of spidery looking bit.
Yeah.
And and the kid's like, "Oh, come on, they're so boring." I mean, can you imagine? Moon school trips. So, yeah, of course, battles are, ever since I read John Keegan, you know, the kind of trying to work out, and you've spent a career doing this, well, what does that mean? Like, what does charge into a line of infantry who then gave way? And I read about, in the period I love is the 18th century, and you read about the Battle of Bladensburg or outside Washington, D.C., when the Brits take Washington. And it just seems like the Redcoats kind of just marched towards lines of U.S. infantry and they exchanged volleys and then the U.S. ran away. But, like, what's the process by which they did that? You know, and then the First World War, an interesting historian said to me the other day, it's interesting, he thinks there was this kind of unwritten rule that you'd go over the top, you would do your best until the officers got killed. And then when the officers were killed, you lay down and waited for dark. And it was then acceptable. The NCOs would then get you back in your trench. They go, all right, lads, come on, back we go. We had to go. Let's go back. So as long as your junior, as long as the kind of keen 19-year-old from Harrow was up at the front going, go on, lads, we come, we might get through the barbed wire here, let's go. You had to sort of go, right, come on, let's follow him and let's do our best. The minute he got killed, and the captain and the major, you were allowed to just go, right, well, this hasn't worked.
Okay.
Basically, so, and I think that the kind of, I love the mechanics by which, and you know, in your period, what's it mean when one battle, you know, that expression in the medieval period, like a battle of troops, like march and like a battle of Tewkesbury, we're talking on the anniversary of the battle of Tewkesbury. And then how long did that last? How long would two bodies of infantry at push of pike, as they say in the later century, you know, like properly at each other's shield wall, knocking each other to bits, pushing, shoving. Was there a clever rotation system that was bringing fresh blood into the front line, like I've seen it argued in the Roman period? Or did it just like, or scared, or a rumour went up, did the whole thing just disintegrate? Like, I agree. I would just love, I don't feel I know that. And I've spent my life reading and sort of trying to look into this. And I still don't feel I know what did Tewkesbury actually look like?
Yeah. I mean, how intense was the actual fighting? Because if you think about professional fighters today, what, a 2.5 minute round and they then need to rest, not wearing anything particularly, they're stripped down, they're super fit, their nutrition is studied, they're fed, they're being battered around, but they're properly fighting. If you're wearing armor and you're not fit and you've got dysentery, your efficiency is going to be dramatically reduced. And even if you're standing opposite somebody who's got a halberd and he's having a swing at you, you're having a swing at him, are you even going to put much strength into it? Or are you just sort of all going to stand there, kind of meet eyes and go, you know what, can we just not kill each other? Is that all right? Yeah. And to sort of make a good show of it and then sit down or something.
Yeah, and I think what really supports that view is that the winning side of many of these battles suffered so few casualties, even when the butcher's bill was vast for the losing side. So it really does imply that the lives were lost in the rout.
Mm.
So the minute you start running away and your cohesion's lost, as you well know, Jason comes in on his horse and just starts hammering the infantry running away, right? Because then ones and twos, they've thrown away their weapons, they've torn off their helmets, they can run faster. And you guys just come in and absolutely butcher them. And I think that's, you know, we mentioned Tautner. That's my suspicion, is that in the kind of decisive engagement, it's something else. It's not pure bloodshed. It could be weight of numbers. It could be the psychopath theory of war. It could be like, there's about 15 or 20 blokes who are massively into it.
Yes.
And they, you know, like Harry Hotspur, they kill everyone. It's like Harry Hotspur at the Battle of Shrewsbury just goes on like an absolute rampage, or Hardrada at Stamford Bridge. And if that is successful in sort of penetrating enemy shield wall and then they kind of lose cohesion, then everyone just runs. They goes, right, screw this, we're running away. Mm. Or you obviously kill the enemy leader and ostentatiously they fall. You're like, right, well, I'm not dying for Godwinson anymore because he's gone. So I wonder if it's like, you know, you've got your kind of psychopathic, your kind of almost your Bronze Age heroes who are really on quite a small scale, even though they're big armies, all the action's in one kind of tiny bit.
Mm.
Or whether there is, you know, and I think things like you accidentally end up outflanking someone, or at Tewkesbury, there's that weird, completely accidental outflanking where a very small number of Yorkist troops crash into the Lancastrian flank, which just panics everyone, I think, and they just all sort of run. And so I think it's probably that kind of thing. And having been in crowds in festivals and sporting occasions, you do get a sense that everyone's looking, you know, and I've been on a few political things which have turned physical, but you are looking at the very small group of people that are making the noise and the energy over there. And you get the impression if it goes wrong, then you run, you know. So that's my impression of how it must go, but you know much better than
me. Well, I was wondering whether that's the whole concept of the heroic archetype, which in fact is the psychopath. So, you know, go back all the way to the ancients, and there were a whole bunch of ordinary people like us.
Yeah.
And then there were one or two absolute psychopaths like Achilles or Hector, who, you know, for one reason or another, probably were genuine psychopaths, princes or whatever. Sorry if I've insulted anybody, but, you know, that maybe they were the ones that were happy to do the slaughter, and everybody else just sort of like backed away quietly and tried to get on with looking like extras in the background of a movie and sort of pretending to fight, but sort of tacitly agreeing between them, a bit like the truce during the, you know, First World War in the trenches at Christmas, everybody tacitly agreeing, right now, we're just not going to kill each other, all right? You know, we'll let the psychopaths battle it out. And in fact, the sort of heroic archetype is all the psychopaths. There's like a tiny percentage of any army are the ones doing the actual damage. Yeah. and everybody else is trying not to be spotted by a psychopath on the other side, or by anybody who might get them into trouble for not putting enough energy into that. And I sometimes look at old classic movies, you know, battle scenes, you know, sort of some of the sword and sandals stuff, Spartacus or whatever it might be. And if you look in the background, you can see people unconvincingly fighting each other. You know, they've obviously been doing it all day and they're both knackered and they're trying not to sort of be spotted by anybody or get into trouble for not fighting well enough. And I wonder whether if that movie fighting isn't actually quite similar.
Yes, so interesting.
To a real battle. With the vast bulk of people going, I have got nothing against you, mate. I'm really sorry, but I'm not going to kill you either. So just make a show of it, please.
Well, I think you're completely right. And there's a really interesting whole field of scholarship at the moment, isn't there, about people's unwillingness to kill people. And, you know, famously at the Battle of Gettysburg, they recovered rifles off the field of battle and many of them have been reloaded many, many times on the urgings of a sergeant and not discharged. So you just had like nine balls in them. And we know that the proximity to the other human makes that impulse even greater. So it's easier to kill someone, as we know, with a drone strike that is from Las Vegas, and you kind of look at grainy video of a Afghan compound and push the button, then go off and have a Starbucks. Now, for that drone operator to go into that compound and knife everybody there in the guts is it's the same impact, it's the same effect, but it's very, very different. So I think that's the interesting thing about the Industrial Revolution, isn't it? That it made it easier to convince. It made it easier for people to kill people, basically.
Yeah.
And, you know, nice lads in Lancaster bombers flying up every night who wouldn't have thought about punching a German, let alone incinerating them and their family, are responsible for the death of... And, of course, all sides did this in the 20th century. And then the ultimate, obviously, extension of that is that one day someone will push a button and obliterate an entire country, or part of a continent, through nuclear munitions. And that, I think, on a medieval battlefield where you are staring into the eyes of people, you're right. You're going to be like, look, mate, we're both here because we've been told to be here. But the aristos, the people with the leaders, the people who gained the most, or sought to gain the most, you could see they might be bloody going for it in the middle there.
Yeah.
A really unpleasant little gang of 50 or 100 dudes just going after each other in the middle and everyone else kind of slightly watching them and see who gets the upper hand.
But because I do think one of the reasons, because I'm fascinated by the slow adoption of black powder weapons in the medieval period. I mean, they first sort of, the handguns sort of come in around the end, 1380s, 1390s, but don't really get taken up until... 100, 150 years later. And one of the things I'm thinking about is they're grossly inaccurate, which makes them really random. And if you're nobility and you've got your really expensive horse and your really expensive armor, and the chances are only another posh guy with the expensive kit stands a chance of killing you, so you're broadly safe against the bulk of the warfare, yet some oik with a hand cannon aims at somebody else and the bullet pings off in another direction and goes straight through your breastplate and kills you. I wonder whether the nobility went, you know what, that's not fair. I'm being killed by randomness, not by some other mighty knight who's taken me on. And same with crossbows as well. It seems to be this tendency to believe that warfare should be not exactly noble, but should be not random. And when you start introducing gunpowder weapons, artillery, bombing, these become more and more displaced from directed killing, and they come indirect killing. As you said, you know, launching a drone strike is a computer game. I mean, they even use computer game controllers or similar things to computer game controllers. And it literally, you've got layers of glass between you and the target. And I kind of wonder whether people didn't adopt the gun because it was too random and just leveled the playing field too much. And then you had to get down off your horse, otherwise you're a target. And then you had to not wear the posh kit because you're too much of a target. And then you actually started to direct the battle from 20 miles away via radio. There's a general trend there. The more in charge of the army you are, as armies became more industrialized, the less chance the senior people were actually involved in the direct combat.
I'm certain that's right. I'm certain that's right. There's no honor in it. There's no honor in getting killed on the battlefield by a yucky little smoky weapon in the hands of a peasant, is there?
No, none whatsoever. In fact, it's arguably embarrassing. The nobility would definitely not want to be killed by an embarrassing circumstance. You want to be killed heroically. Yeah. You want to be Richard III charging in, you know, taking out the banner bearer of Henry Tudor, the usurper, and failing heroically. You know, that's the sort of arguably one of the last grand gestures of the medieval period. And what a way to end a period with a king losing his kingdom on the battlefield in that fantastic way. And add to that his scoliosis and his physical impairment. You know, what an incredibly interesting person to have a go at doing that. But yes, I think we're nearly out of time, I'm afraid, you know.
Well, I could talk about this all day, bud. So let's make sure we do it again.
Definitely.
In person with a drink in hand.
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely. Was there anything you wanted to kind of promote or sort of mention to the audience? Just normally History Hit, which is great. I'm a subscriber.
Well, it's so kind of you, man. Thank you for your support from the beginning. Yeah. But yeah, no, History Hit TV is really exciting. We make, you know, proper historical documentaries. We're trying to get better all the time, more ambition all the time for true history fans. And then the old podcast, well, History Hit podcast.
Fabulous. Brilliant, Dan. Well, that's been a pleasure, and we could literally have talked for another few hours, but I'm aware that you're quite busy. I don't know how you do so much. I genuinely don't.
Well, come on, dude. You're running a bloody great big massive multi-trillion dollar business empire as well as doing all the stuff you do, so I won't take that from you, man.
Thank you for saying so. Brilliant.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.